George MacLeod, a Scottish preacher, had a rather sharp wit and mind and an incisive way of describing his own people. And he once said that Scottish Christians reminded him a great deal of Confucianists. And when he defined what a Confucianist was, it's a person who makes occasional visits to the shrines of his ancestors. I don't think I could in fairness say that you are a group of Confucianists because you aren't here because of it being a special holiday. You're not here for an occasional visit to a shrine of an ancestor. And yet it would appear that a great deal of what is called Christianity could be summarized in that way. We do have a way of feeling a tug of the past, a little twinge of conscience, perhaps a homesickness, a longing for a spirit of thankfulness we knew in earlier years. And it comes back to us around Thanksgiving Day, or at Christmas time, or at Easter time, or at special times of observance on the calendar, when we are reminded in a unique fashion of what has been made available for us in Christ. We passed through a period where people didn't like to think about the past. After all, George Washington may have had his problems, but he didn't have a button he could push that would devastate half the earth. Grandmother may have been very busy, but she never had any worries about abortion or heroin. We'd best take care of the problems of now. We haven't time to remember the past or to dwell upon history. There are signs that we're emerging from that now with a new appreciation for the past that may go the other direction and become romantic, nostalgic. We tend to think that God was great in the past. He did great things in the past, and there were great people in the past. But our time is a bit of a shadow of what once was known. To relegate God to the past and be thankful only for what happened then is to miss the real point of his action in our world today. So somewhere else, the spirit of thanksgiving has to emerge, rather than just by thinking about the past or by forgetting the past. Christianity is a religion of history. As the Old Testament was anchored in the Exodus, the New Testament is anchored in the cross. And there is some remembering to do. But thanksgiving sometimes is left by the wayside because we don't really appreciate the past or the present as we ought. Maybe thanksgiving runs into a bit of trouble too, because it was easy when Psalm 100 was written to realize what God was doing through nature and the farm, the field. The psalmist not only penned Psalm 100, Psalm 92 says it's a good thing to offer thanks to God. And all around Psalm 100 are psalms of thanksgiving. But in those days, the Israelites were keenly aware of the fact that they'd just come out of Egyptian bondage and been led to the promised land, that their crops every year were given them by God. And knowing what they had to be thankful for, this spirit of thanksgiving emerged. But what is there to be thankful for in our time? After all, we face a good bit of inflation. We face problems with our basic political processes and integrity in carrying them out. We face pollution and the draining of our resources. We seem to have more complaints than we do areas in which we ought to be full of thanksgiving. So while there was an awareness of God and his goodness then, in a simpler time, ours is a too complex time, and we tend to dwell on the problems instead of dwelling on the areas for which we ought to be thankful. I really think there's a third reason that's greater than either of the two I've mentioned, either the failure to reflect upon what God has done and is doing, or the failure to remember that even though there are problems, there's much to be thankful for. I think affluence is probably the greatest enemy of thanksgiving. Someone has said that the people who are not thankful are either the people who have nothing for which to be thankful or the people who have everything for which to be thankful. And I believe we fit in the second category. We have so much for which to be thankful that we tend to forget our sense of dependence at all. An Israelite may have been aware that God was blessing his crops and bringing forth his fruit, giving the rains that brought the fruitful seasons. But nowadays, the computer can pretty well project for us what the yield is going to be, and we know the kind of fertilizers to use. We know exactly the kind of grass to rotate with the crop. We know how to balance the price of corn and the price of hogs and sort of make it all come out even. And with the aid of the scientific devices we have to pay farmers not to raise food. To think of a harvest that isn't bountiful would be the very unusual thing for us. In such a time of affluence, it's difficult to remember that God is the source of everything. We begin to think it's our scientific research and know-how which form the source of everything. But I suppose if it made sense to be thankful for the pumpkin when our ancestor could barely hold on to the shore as he had climbed onto these coasts and barely hoped that he had enough fruit to last him through the winter until the next crop came in, if it was sensible to be thankful for the pumpkin then, it might be sensible to be thankful for the computer now. There was a time when the person who went out in a boat had to pray for the right kind of wind, or at least hope it came, or else his boat was not going anywhere. We have motors now. And after all, when you can buy a motor with several horsepower, why worry about the direction of the wind? Just go when you're ready. Or there was a time when the fisherman who had the job of bringing in the fish, upon which people were absolutely dependent for their food, may have prayed for the fish catch to be good. We have electronic gear now in the ship. We know where the fish are. We know how to catch them. But if it made sense to be thankful for the wind that drove the boat, it makes sense to be thankful for the motor that pushes it. And if it was important to be thankful for the fish when they were caught without men knowing where they were, it's important to be thankful for the electronic gear that helps us know where they are. In a time of affluence, though, it's easy to forget that. What I want to underline this morning, then, maybe a little late. Most Thanksgiving sermons are preached the week before because people are tired of hearing it by now. But I'd like to underline some of the things that we ought to be thankful for. I haven't, for 2 or 3 years, taken advantage of the weekend to emphasize a strain that runs very heavily through the Bible, a strain of living with Thanksgiving as a part of daily life. The first thing I'd like to underline that makes Psalm 100 important is that we do have a great deal for which to be thankful in our time. I've just been trying to emphasize that it seems indirect and secondary now. Man's gear seems to have come between him and the source of the blessing to the point that the source is obscured. But it isn't very difficult for any one of us to look about him and find a number of things in his nation and in his life for which to give thanks to God. If you look at our nation as a whole, that's the way Thanksgiving was born, as a special holiday. A time of thanks born out of the Civil War, really, rather than the Pilgrims' time, as a national annual holiday, for what God had done for a nation. And there's still a great deal for which to be thankful at that point. After all, we have the most viable, the most durable democracy in the world. We have an absolute freedom to assemble without any real concern of harm while we assemble. 1/3 to 1/2 the world's population does not enjoy that freedom this morning. Just recently, Wall Street Journal carried an article telling the story of recent attempts at robbery, with almost every other source exhausted in our time. There have been a number of instances where robbers have come into church assemblies and have caused everyone to hold up the hands, and they've just robbed the assembly. A little closer to home, we've had instances of where the treasury was taken away before it could be gotten to the bank. And people who are responsible for church finances are rather keenly aware of a problem that didn't exist a few years ago. But aside from a few bizarre incidents like this, we assemble without any real fear. We speak and write our minds without any fear at all. There may be an area like an airport corridor where we can't really speak with jest anymore because too many people abused a privilege, took advantage of freedom, and brought havoc to other people's lives. But aside from a restricted area here or there, we may say or write what we please. We enjoy an unprecedented freedom. We're very diverse people who've been collected together on the shores of America. Coming from all sorts of backgrounds, we brought together a nation that, when it faces a challenge like World War II, seems to have a way of giving itself to the task and emerging victoriously. We brought together a nation which, when it decides it wants to put a man on the moon within a decade, uses the 60s for space exploration and does it. It's almost a foregone conclusion that whatever we decide to do, we're going to do, if scientific research can bring us there. It's an unusual nation for which to be thankful. But aside from the political and social and scientific processes, there's the heritage of faith we enjoy in the nation and individually and in our families. Can you imagine what it would be like to be in a land without faith? Again, 1/3 to 1/2 the world rests in that kind of circumstance where faith cannot be freely enjoyed and acted upon. What would life be like where there is no Bible,
Well, there's no awareness of where truth is, or what truth is, or how to be made free by truth. We've known so long it's taken for granted now. What would it be like to have no fellowship with fellow Christians? To have no men like Moses and Isaiah and Amos and Paul that we could count fellow heirs of the grace of life and of God's plan of redemption, whose lives we could refer to as sources for the conduct of our own lives? The heritage of faith we have is a great deal for which to be thankful. Individually, we've had our joys and our successes, and we've had our tragedies and our failures. But every one of us who has walked through the valley of tragedy and failure knows what it's like to have somebody there to comfort, families upon which to rely, a faith in God that sustains in the darkest hour of crisis. There is a great deal in our time to be thankful for. That's the first lesson, it seems to me, of Psalm 100. The 103rd Psalm states it almost as vividly. As the psalmist says, "Bless the Lord, O my soul," and you might translate the word bless, "thank the Lord, O my soul," and not miss anything at all. You'd really have the thought. "And all that is within me, bless his holy name. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits, who forgives all your iniquities and heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from the pit or from Hades, who crowns you with steadfast love and mercy, who satisfies you with good as long as you live, so that your youth is renewed like the eagles." And on through Psalm 103, the Spirit is, "Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless his name." There's a great deal for which to be thankful. A second thing, it seems to me, that is underlined by a passage like Psalm 100 is that thanksgiving is supposed to emerge in lifestyle, in a way of conduct, not just in a voice. That is, we don't just send God thank you notes because we're very well-mannered. We do something because we appreciate what he has done for us in life. A son or a daughter who appreciates the rearing he's had in a family shows that appreciation by a kind of life. Not just by endless words of thanks to father and mother, but by the way he or she lives. A citizen who is grateful for what a country has provided lives a life that brings honor to that country and helps to strengthen its fiber. That's the real way of showing one's thanks. Thanksgiving, as it was called in one of our prayers, not just thanksgiving. A reaction that comes through doing and not just through voicing. It's an awfully easy step when one becomes accustomed to a praise service to reach the point where one praises with words and doesn't praise with life. I don't think we know the Old Testament prophets as well as we know the historical section of the Old Testament. But one of the burdens of the prophets was that Israel had become very adept at worship services and very empty in the quality of her living. So prophet after prophet called attention to the fact that there is a hiatus between the way you live and the way you talk. And it has to be healed before God is really going to have anything to do with you. Isaiah in his first chapter says, "When you come to appear before me, who requires of you this trampling of my courts?" To think of God describing worship, coming into the temple, the holy place to worship him, as trampling on his courts, but Isaiah does. "Bring no more vain offerings. Incense is an abomination to me. New moon and Sabbath and the calling of assemblies, I cannot endure iniquity and solemn assembly." God authorized those new moons. He called those assemblies. But he says, "I cannot endure iniquity and solemn assembly. Your new moons and your appointed feasts, my soul hates. They have become a burden to me. I'm weary of hearing them. When you spread forth your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood. Wash yourselves. Make yourselves clean. Remove the evil of your doings from before my eyes. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good. Seek justice. Correct oppression. Defend the fatherless. Plead for the widow." Isaiah is obviously saying, you're doing one thing in my courts and another thing out in daily life. You're oppressing the fatherless, the widow. You're taking advantage of everyone who is unable to defend himself, and then coming into my courts and trampling them down with all your praise services. Bring the two together, your life and your words. Jeremiah made a similar appeal in his 7th chapter. "Behold, you trust in deceptive words to no avail. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, burn incense to Baal, and go after other gods that you have not known, and then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered? That's an almost unthinkable scene. But Jeremiah says that around 600 BC it was going on. The Israelites were swearing falsely. They were committing adultery. They were committing murder. They were doing whatever they wished, serving other gods, and then coming and standing in God's house and saying, we're delivered. Amos has much the same burden. In chapter 5, verses 21 through 24, he says, I hate, I despise your feasts. I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and cereal offerings, I will not accept them. And the peace offerings of your fatted beasts I will not look upon. Take away from me all the noise of your songs. To the melody of your harps I will not listen. But let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. What God wanted to hear instead of those voices and those harps was a bit of justice rolling down in Israel, some righteousness flowing like a stream. There's such a separation between the way they live and the way they talk. Israel has become extremely adept at offering her services, but terrible in the way she conducts her life. Jesus called attention to the same problem. In Matthew 5, 23 and 24, he said, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift at the altar. First go and be reconciled with your brother, then come and offer your gift. Again, he's pointing to a difference between the way they live and the way they bring their sacrifices to God. He's calling for a lifestyle that is filled with thanksgiving, not just words. If you bring your sacrifice to God and you remember there's some break between you and another member of the human race, the thing to do is go and be reconciled to that person. There's a responsibility that comes with what we know, with what we've been given, that's supposed to issue in a thanksgiving life. In Luke 12, Jesus said, unto whom much is given, of him shall much be required. Seems to me that's a very frightening text, because we've been given so much. Much is required from us in the form of living and not just words of politeness toward God. I recently read the story of a medical missionary who'd gone to Tanzania, and he was telling one of those heart-rending stories that all of us would like to do more about than we're able to do. But he'd gone to a country with an average income per capita of $70 a year, where in the towns there will be one doctor for every 20,000 people, and in the country one for every 100,000 people, where 2 out of 10 people have lost the use of at least one eye, where a mother who has 8 children counts herself lucky if she raises 2 of them to adulthood. He points to a situation where so much help is needed, and where we realize the need for help and find so few ways of getting it there. But unless we can raise up the people to go, unless we can live with the constant concern, a lot of things will remain out of reach forever. I know that America has given over $150 billion in foreign aid since the Second World War. Our companies have spent $75 billion more in foreign investment. A great deal has been done, but so much remains to be done. There is a kind of living that is to issue out of what we've received. Thanksgiving. Two things. There's much to be thankful for, and our thankfulness is to emerge in a kind of living and not just a kind of talking. There's one other thing I want to underline, and that is that there's a therapy, a kind of growth that comes out of thanksgiving. I've known a good many complaining people, people who always tended to see the darker side of any situation. I've never known one of those that I thought was really happy. And on the other hand, I can't remember ever having known any person whose life was constantly filled with thanksgiving who did not appear to be a happy person. I think there's a close association between the two. I've known situations where being a minister was sort of like manning a complaint desk for God, taking all the complaints that have their way of coming about the way he operates the world or doesn't operate in a given situation. But I think that's a rather unfortunate view of what the ministry is for or what the Christian life is about. There's a different kind of spirit in the Bible. Job loses everything he has, even his children. But he says, The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. If we again translated it, thanks to the name of the Lord, we'd have his thought. The New Testament has the same kind of spirit. Paul impresses you that way. He seldom, if ever, writes a letter without taking time in the letter to express the thanksgiving he feels for the people he's writing. You see it in a chapter like Philippians 1 most clearly, but it's there scattered all through his letters. He was always thankful to God for the other people who were sharing what he was doing in the work of Christ, who shared the common faith. He could write a passage like Philippians 4 and it just seemed to issue out of his life. Have no anxiety about anything, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. He could write 1 Thessalonians 5:18, give thanks in all circumstances, and recall an awful lot of strange circumstances in which he had given thanks. Even the hard days of life, Paul realized there was a value in. Even the things we count not too pleasant may be character strengtheners, and there's a source of thanksgiving to be found in them. I don't know how many of you grew up on the farm as I did, but there are a lot of those childhood scenes from the farm that are very vivid all through life. And I think there's none more vivid than the scene that I witnessed a good many times. When you take that bushel basket of corn and throw it over the fence to all that herd of hogs, strange thing happened almost every time. One hog grabbed almost the first ear that hit the ground, and he ran with it as if it were the only ear in the bushel. And the thing that was stranger still was that almost every other hog in the herd followed him as if he had the only ear. Everybody else squealed. They just had to have that one ear of corn. All the rest was overlooked. And we human beings are so much like that. We spend so much time dwelling on what we have not received in life, and so little time thinking about all the things we have received. There's a great deal in our time to be thankful for. But thanksgiving is something that issues in life and not just in words. And there's a therapy about it that helps one grow. There's a paralysis of spirit that comes through constant complaining. And there's a growth and broadening of spirit that comes through gratitude and thanksgiving. But for an awful lot of us, thanksgiving hasn't begun. Because it begins with a surrender of life, with a turning from self, with a burial of the old person, and the beginning of a new life. Do you need to begin? Would you? While we sing.
For me so weak and sinful.